Well, there is a big difference, isn't there, between hearing and listening? There's a big difference between hearing and listening. The difference between hearing and listening is like the difference between night and day. That's what Kevin Gilliland, a psychologist, said. So he says that the difference between hearing and listening is like the difference between night and day. He says that hearing is like collecting data. But you know that listening is very different, isn't it? Listening is paying attention. It's giving what you hear proper consideration, careful consideration. It's responding appropriately. And you know that difference, don't you? Because when you were a child and your mum or your dad asked you to put your shoes away, you may have heard what they said, but there's a big difference between hearing it and listening to it. You know that many children will hear what their parents are saying to them and yet not necessarily listen. And so 20 minutes later, the shoes are still not in the shoe cupboard. So there is a big difference between hearing and listening. And the reason we've been thinking about this is because of this verse. Verse 7 in chapter 9, where God the Father says this of Jesus: "This is my Son, whom I love. Listen to him." This is my Son who I love. Listen to him. And there are reasons, as we've already been thinking about, why we sometimes don't listen to Jesus. Sometimes it is because there are other voices who distract us from him. Why would we listen to him in particular when many other people seem to have wisdom? Sometimes we don't listen to him because we don't like what we're hearing, or we think we know better in terms of how to live our lives. And yet God the Father says to us that this is his beloved Son, and so we are to listen to him. And so we want to think about what will keep us listening, or maybe get us listening in the first place. What will get us listening, or what will keep us listening, not just hearing Jesus as we read the Bible, as he speaks to us through the Bible? What will keep us listening? We're just going to think about two factors here. We're going to think about getting a glimpse of Jesus' glory, and we're going to think about keeping sight of his suffering. So getting a glimpse of his glory and keeping a sight of his suffering, these two factors will keep us listening to Jesus. And so let's think first of all about this glimpse of his glory. In verse 2, after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. Now you know what it's like to go up a high mountain. If you're anything like me, you're about 20 minutes in and you've start feeling it on the hamstrings, and the air starts to get a little bit more cool and clear and thin. You get a bit of a distance from your kind of day-to-day life, and you get views over the countryside. Well, Mark draws our attention to these details in this verse, that after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain. And in verse 7, Mark highlights for us that a cloud appears and a voice came from the cloud. And you wonder why Mark chooses to highlight those particular details. Well, if you're familiar with the Old Testament, it may ring some bells with you. So back in Exodus, you don't need to turn there, but back in Exodus, listen to this. The Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain." Then Moses set out with Joshua, his assistant, and Moses went up on the mountain of God. When Moses went up on the mountain, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai. For 6 days, the cloud covered the mountain, and on the seventh day, the Lord called to Moses from within the cloud. And so you can see the parallels between what Mark is saying and what was said back in Exodus, that what was happening in Exodus is somehow informing and helping us to understand what's going on in Mark's gospel. The 6 days, the small few people going up the mountain, the cloud, the voice from the cloud of God. And as we head up the mountain with Jesus, Peter, James, and John, who do we meet? Well, in verse 4, there appeared before them Elijah and Moses. Elijah and Moses. So Moses, as you know, was the one at the beginning, through whom God called his people out of Egypt and began to settle them in the land. So he's right at the kind of the beginning of the story of God's people, in a sense. And then Elijah is right towards the end of the Old Testament, where the people have been scattered, and he's calling them back. Not calling them back geographically, but calling them back to God. They have been walking in their own ways, and so Elijah, right at the end, is calling the people back to God. And that's who we meet on the mountain, Moses and Elijah. But what becomes apparent, very obviously, is that Jesus is greater than Moses and Elijah. So we see that in verse 2. At the end of the verse, it says, "There he was transfigured before them." What does that look like? Well, verse 3, "His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them." And so what we have here is Jesus' clothes becoming dazzling white, becoming whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. But that doesn't happen to Moses' clothes. That doesn't happen to Elijah's clothes. And so it's as though, visually, what we're seeing is Jesus eclipsing Moses and Elijah. Jesus outshining Moses and Elijah, literally. Because he is greater than them. And it may also remind you of the idea of resurrection, where somebody who is resurrected is clothed in these bright white clothes. It's as if we're seeing Jesus as the king, getting a glimpse of his glory, getting a glimpse of who he is in that moment, but also who he will be when he is raised from the dead. He is greater than Moses and Elijah. That's clear visually, and it's also clear in terms of the role that he takes on. So it's interesting, when Moses goes up Mount Sinai, he speaks with God. And when Elijah goes up Mount Horeb, which is Sinai, he speaks with God. And so you might think, well, Moses, Elijah, and Jesus will go up this mountain and speak with God, but that's not what happens. In verse 4, what happens is that Elijah and Moses were talking with Jesus. They're speaking with Jesus. Jesus is in the place of God here. Jesus is the one that they are speaking with, as though Jesus is the one who is the source of all that they know about God, all that has been revealed to them about God. And so he is in that place. He's not on a par with them. He is greater than them because he is the Son of God. He's the Son of God. If a human being has a son, that son is in their nature a human being. And if God has a son, that son is in his nature God. And so what we see is this glimpse of Jesus glory as the Son of God, and you wonder, what do you do with that? Well, Peter, the apostle, has an idea. So in verse 5, Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, teacher, it's good for us to be here. Let us make three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." Now maybe he's thinking, okay, these guys are on an equal footing, so we'll make one shelter for each. Maybe he's thinking, this is wonderful, this mountaintop experience. I could get used to this. Let's stay here a while. Let's linger. Let's put up the tents. Let's go for the weekend camping option. Well, who knows what he's thinking? He doesn't seem to know what he's thinking himself. In verse 6, he did not know what to say. That never stops Peter from saying something. He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. I mean, these first followers of Jesus, when they give accounts of what they have seen, they're not the heroes. They're not the ones who are saying, "Oh, of course we knew this was going to happen. We saw this coming." No, they're scared out of their wits when they see Jesus for who he is, when they get a glimpse of his glory. And that fear of Jesus, that holy reverence, as we were singing about, doesn't drive Peter away from Jesus. It compels Peter to listen And that is exactly what God the Father says to Peter in verse 7. This is my son whom I love. Listen to him. When they get a glimpse of his glory, they realize, and God makes it clear to them, listen to him. He is the Son of God. He's the Son of God. Not another Moses, not another Elijah, not just another prophet, or as some would claim, not just like Muhammad. No. He's not just a rabbi or a teacher, as Peter calls him here. He's the Son of God. So listen to him, God says. C.S. Lewis says this about how we think about Jesus. C.S. Lewis says, I'm trying to hear to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about Jesus. That I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That's the one thing we must not say, C.S. Lewis says. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic, this is C.S. Lewis speaking, on the level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or he would be the devil of hell. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. Let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about him being a great human teacher. He's not left that open to us. He did not intend to. And what we're given here is a glimpse of Jesus' glory so that we may be left in no doubt that he is the Son of God and that we should listen to him. Not just generally, although that is true, but specifically what he has just said. He has just said that the Son of Man, referring to himself, he must suffer and be rejected and be killed and rise from the dead. And if you want to follow him, to take up your cross and follow him. That's specifically what we need to listen to, God says, of Jesus. And that is not something that is easy to listen to. The idea of dying to ourselves and our decisions and our will and our way. But if we get this glimpse of his glory and have this holy reverence or holy fear towards him, not to cause us to run away, but it causes us to listen to him. Who else in your life could compare with Jesus? Who else has this level of authority? Who else has this level of power? Whoever else has this level of glory, but the Son of God? That you would listen to somebody else over Jesus about how to live? Is there anyone who you'd prefer to entrust your life to than the Son of God? Well, if we're going to listen to him, we need to get this glimpse of his glory, and secondly, we need to keep sight of his suffering. We need to keep seeing his suffering, because this glimpse of his glory is sandwiched between Jesus speaking about his suffering. He has said it in the previous chapter, and he says it again in verse 9. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from where? From the dead. From among the dead ones. And again in verse 12, the second half of the verse, why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? This glimpse of Jesus' glory is sandwiched between him talking about his suffering and death. And the disciples just cannot figure out how these two ideas go together. In verse 10, they kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. They're trying to figure it out, how these ideas are connected. And so they ask him in verse 11, why did the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? And you're thinking, wow, that's quite a rabbit trail they're chasing there. What are they even talking about? Well, they're not too far off. You see, in their minds, they knew, or they had heard, or they had read in the Old Testament that God was going to send Elijah, this great prophet. And Elijah would prepare people for the coming of God. He would call people back to God. And so they would be ready to meet with God and be restored to fellowship with God. But then they're thinking, well, if Elijah's going to come first and people are going to be coming back to God, why then would they kill Jesus? That doesn't look like restoration. That doesn't look like harmony with God. Well, Jesus says in verse 12, to be sure, Elijah does come first and restores all things. That does happen, but Jesus says is not how you expect. In the second half of verse 12, he asks this question, why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? Jesus keeps pressing this. I'm going to suffer and be rejected and die. And the question again is, how do these two truths get put together? The idea that God is at work to restore all things, and the idea that Jesus would suffer and die. They're like oil and water in a jar. Just no matter how much you try, you cannot combine them. But Jesus does combine them. He points us in the right direction in verse 13 when he says, I tell you, Elijah has come. The disciples thought Elijah had yet to come. Jesus says, he's come. Did you not recognize him? He was the guy walking around with camel's hair clothing, eating locusts and wild honey, and calling people back to God. It was John the Baptist. He was this prophet of God. Not Elijah reincarnated, but Elijah. If you looked at John, you would see Elijah. So similar in terms of how he looked and what he was calling people to. And Jesus says he's come already. It's already begun. But look at what they did to Elijah. Look at what they did to John the Baptist. They have done to him, verse 13, everything they wished, just as it is written about him. Jesus makes it clear this wasn't unexpected. This too was written about him. What did they do to him? Just as they wished. They removed his head. On the whim of a leader, Herod, John was beheaded. In this incredible miscarriage of justice. And Jesus points his disciples to that because he's saying to them, look, this is what they did to John. And you can be sure that they're going to do the same to me. And so Jesus says, in order to get to resurrection, there needs to be death. In order to get to restoration, Jesus is going to have to die. In order to get to this glory that we get a glimpse of, Jesus is going to suffer and be killed. That is the road that he is going to walk. In order to bring about the restoration of all things. And all who trust in him, all who believe in him, all who listen to him. And that helps us to listen to him, doesn't it? Because it is far easier to listen to somebody who has suffered. When we are suffering, we don't want somebody coming along saying to us, it'll be fine, it'll be grand, who have never experienced it. But Jesus has experienced profound suffering and gone to his death for you. And so we can listen to him, assured that we are in safe hands. He knows what you are going through because he has experienced it himself. It enables us to listen to him. And it's easier to listen to him when we know what the outcome is going to be because we cannot see what lies ahead. But we know the outcome is secure because he has gone ahead of us. He has finished the journey in a sense. He has gone through the cross. He has been raised from the dead. He is seated at the right hand of God. And he's waiting for us. Suffering, not knowing where you're going, is so demoralizing. But we know where we're going because Jesus has gone before us, and so we take up our cross and follow him. And it's easier for us to listen to him when he calls us to die to ourselves and die to our sin, when we realize that this is what he has died for, to save us, to make us his own so that we might walk in his ways. And so we get this glimpse of Jesus' glory. We want to keep seeing his suffering as we read about it. We need to remember what he has done for us. But you know, for the disciples, the glimpse of glory fades for a time, doesn't it? In verse 9, they come down the mountain. The glimpse of glory is gone, and they are on their way to Jerusalem. So as they continue through the Gospel of Mark, it becomes more and more clear. They're headed to Jerusalem, and Jesus is headed to the cross. And so suffering starts to fill their vision and overwhelm them as the glimpse of glory fades. But you know, because Jesus is risen, one day the suffering that we experience will fade. And then we'll get not just a glimpse of his glory, we will get a permanent, enduring, everlasting sight of who Jesus is. We will be with him forever. In following Jesus in the here and now, in this life, there is no glory without suffering. We take up our cross and we follow him. But in following Jesus, there's no suffering without glory, sooner or later. We realize that he is working all things out, even our suffering, somehow for the good of those who love him. And we know that one day we will awake in his presence and we will be like him. He will have made us what he intended to. He will have completed the work in us. And so we listen to him. We keep listening to him. And what will enable us to do that is to get this glimpse of his glory and to keep sight of his suffering. Let's take a moment to pray. Father, help us to fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. Help us to see him for who he is, your beloved Son, that he is God in the flesh, God incarnate. Help us to see that more vividly, more clearly as we read about him in your word. And Lord, help us too to see that he entered into this world in order to suffer, to be rejected, to be killed, and to rise again. And Lord, that we can listen to him because he has firsthand experience of what it is to live in this world. Help us, Lord, more and more to listen to our Savior. Amen.